You know, I often read stories or articles about being gay, and it's almost like it's this ready-made existence. Whereas it's a created culture. A straight society is also created. We all have the codes that we are living by or supposed to live by, and the signals that we're supposed to pick up. If you don't fit in, you have to figure out what those are. "Don't listen to that crap," he said, his eyes elsewhere in the bar, sneaking a look at who his ex-boyfriend was talking to. "Why would you follow some stupid trend? Gay people can be so superficial."
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. German High Court finds life partners law legal, Ontario marriage ruling reverberates provincially, and author Andy Kwan spins common threads into Calendar Boy. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Sherry Lund.
And I'm Brian Nunes.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 20th, 2002. Legal recognition of same-gender partners dominated the news this week. Germany's highest court, the Federal Constitutional Court, in a 5-3 decision upheld the nation's year-old law creating registered life partnerships for gay and lesbian couples, which offer many of the benefits of heterosexual marriage. The states of Bavaria, Saxony, and Thuringia, all ruled by the conservative Christian Democratic Party, the CDU, had challenged the law as a violation of the special status granted marriage under the German Constitution. But the court rejected their challenge, declaring that marriage is neither damaged nor in any other way restricted by life partnerships. Some 4,400 German gay and lesbian couples have contracted life partnerships to date. The law, pushed through by the ruling Red-Green coalition of Social Democrats and Greens, extends spousal benefits in areas including inheritance, health insurance, immigration, shared surnames, hospital visitation, and support payments following dissolution. Partners are granted some parental rights over their partner's children, but gay and lesbian couples may not adopt. A separate government bill to recognize life partners for purposes of taxation, pensions, and social welfare benefits has so far been blocked by the CDU. However, if the CDU prevails in September national elections, the man who would become Germany's chancellor, Bavaria's premier Eric Stoiber, now says he will not seek repeal of the existing partnership law.
Premier Ernie Eves of the Canadian province of Ontario announced this week that his government will not appeal last week's landmark ruling by the provincial superior court granting full legal recognition to marriages of gays and lesbians performed by the gay-affirming Metropolitan Community Church, MCC. The Canadian federal government could still appeal the ruling, but Eves said the national government should act instead to extend equal marriage rights to gay and lesbian couples. That's something only the Netherlands has done. Although many aspects of legal marriage in Canada are controlled by federal laws, the provinces are responsible for registration. Ontario's position in the MCC case had been that it could not register the gay and lesbian marriages because only federal law determines who can legally marry. The provincial court found unanimously that denying the marriages created second-class citizens in violation of the National Charter of Rights and Freedoms, but suspended its ruling for 2 years, hoping the national and provincial governments will redefine marriage in that period. And for now, that leaves Ontario's same-gender couples wishing to marry in limbo, as longtime partners and veteran marriage activists Michael Leshner and Michael Stark discovered this week. With much media fanfare, the men applied for a marriage license at Toronto City Hall, but were turned down until such time as the laws may change.
But while Ontario is sympathetic to gay and lesbian marriage, staunchly conservative Alberta has taken the opposite tack. This week, the provincial legislature passed a private member's bill to block any federal move to allow same-gender marriage by immediately invoking the so-called notwithstanding clause of the Canadian Constitution, which enables a province to disregard a federal law or Canadian Supreme Court ruling. Some attorneys believe this strategy would ultimately fail, and Alberta's own Justice Minister David Hancock did not support the bill. But Premier Ralph Klein affirmed that the provincial government is prepared to invoke the clause against gay and lesbian marriage, calling it the only circumstance under which the notwithstanding clause would be used without a referendum, and it would be automatic. So it simply will not happen in this province. Marriage is where we draw the line.
Meanwhile, Canada's first civil union was contracted this week in the province of Quebec. While equal marriage rights are being contested there as well, Quebec last month created civil unions, extending all the legal recognition the province has jurisdiction to grant to unmarried couples, including gay and lesbian couples. The very first couple to celebrate a civil union there were Roger Thibault and Theo Wooters of the Montreal suburb of Pointe-Claire, who've lived together for nearly 30 years. They had previously gained less happy notoriety as victims of a continuing campaign of anti-gay harassment by two of their neighbors, a situation which led to a march by about 5,000 people in support of the couple and ultimately to a $36,000 Quebec Human Rights Commission judgment against the harassers.
Nova Scotia and Saskatchewan also have registered partnership laws, although not as sweeping as Quebec's, and Manitoba may soon join that list with a bill introduced by its provincial government this week. The bill would extend all marital property rights to couples who've lived together for 3 years, regardless of gender, and create a registry to allow couples to contract those rights from the beginning of their relationships. The rights to be conferred include automatic inheritance should one partner die, and equal division of property should the partnership break up. The bill also provides that couples who do not wish to share property can opt out.
A South African supporter of legal recognition of same-gender couples resigned this week from his post as a Roman Catholic auxiliary bishop. Celibate gay Monsignor Reginald Cockhut of Cape Town had been the target of protests by a U.S. group called the Roman Catholic Faithful for his involvement with a now-defunct Maine-based internet discussion group for gay clergy, even though Cockhut maintained that he consistently promoted celibacy there. His stepping down was mourned by the Lesbian and Gay Equality Project. In his own official statement, Cockhut said, "Because I do not wish to be the cause of any further division in the church, after 40 years of what I believe to have been service to the Lord, I will continue serving the good Lord with a lower profile." After being created a bishop in 1992, Cockhut pioneered church-based care for South Africans with AIDS as a founder and longtime head of the AIDS Office of the South African Catholic Bishops Conference.
In the U.S., the first open gay ever appointed to an executive branch post by a Republican administration was transferred this week. Scott Everts served a little more than a year as director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy and will now serve as senior advisor to the Secretary of Health and Human Services on international efforts against AIDS. Everts' successor is openly gay physician Dr. Joseph O'Neill. Activists are concerned that the reshuffle may signify the ascendancy of the abstinence-only AIDS prevention education approach within the Bush administration, particularly in the wake of the appointment of abstinence advocate Julie Gerberding to head the Centers for Disease Control. The religious right had consistently objected to Everts for his promotion of condom use and association with gay organizations.
A Washington state appeals court this week became the first appellate court in the U.S. ever to declare that the federal constitution protects gay and lesbian civil servants from job discrimination. The Division III Court of Appeals in Spokane was unanimous in overruling a trial court's dismissal of lesbian medical sonographer Mary Jo Davis's lawsuit against Pullman Memorial Hospital. The decision said, "The law is well established that intentional and invidious discrimination against an individual because he or she is a member of an identifiable class violates a person's right to equal protection." The American Civil Liberties Union, which served as Davis's co-counsel, hailed the ruling as a historic victory. The defense intends to appeal it to the Washington State Supreme Court.
Back on the marriage front, a joint session of the Massachusetts state legislature this week killed a proposed amendment to the state constitution to restrict legal marriage and marital benefits to one man and one woman. A petition to place the measure before voters on the November 2004 ballot had garnered 130,000 signatures, twice the minimum required, and had already survived several court hearings amidst allegations that those signatures were fraudulently obtained. A little shy of the 75% of legislators' votes needed to defeat the proposed amendment outright, Democratic lawmakers killed it by procedural means, by adjourning their session. That horrified several hundred of the proposal's supporters who were present at the State House, but gay and lesbian activists rejoiced. MassEquality.org board member Arlene Isaacson told the Boston Globe with tears of joy that it's great that so many legislators understood that we should never put equal rights on the ballot for the popular vote and that the tyranny of the majority should not be allowed to take away the rights of the minority.
And finally, a UK license plate reading Gay One sold at a widely reported auction this week for £15,000. Yet, that was a disappointment to Andrew Saunders, who had hoped it might net him four times as much. He complained to the Mail on Sunday newspaper, "You keep hearing about high-profile personalities saying they're glad to be gay, but no one seems to want to wear the badge on their car." Saunders' father gave him the plate and the vintage MG Stag it was attached to almost 30 years ago. Saunders explained, "It's been fun, but I'm getting a little weary of the rather obvious humor. I'm also fed up with the alarm of hitchhikers who suddenly hide their thumbs when they see the registration. I'm not anti-gay and have had a lot of enjoyment from the plates, but Gay One does not reflect my sexual preference." He noted that, "When my dad got the license, the word had a totally different meaning."
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 20th, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Brian Nunes.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
I'm a little tired of the weary throwaway line that there is no such thing as the gay sensibility. Of course there is such a thing as the gay sensibility. Of course gay men and women think in some fundamental ways differently from straight. It is not just about what we do in bed. It is about the echoes in the culture of who we are or who we aren't. Hi, I'm Clive Barker. Listen to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian news magazine.
Andy Kwan is a Canadian-born Chinese gay activist and author who's also lived and worked in Europe and Australia. In his new collection of short stories called Calendar Boy, recently published by Penguin Books, Kwan uses a number of characters to explore themes that are at once race, gender, and sexual orientation specific, but also universal in their humanity. And This Way Out's Sydney, Australia correspondent Michael Schembri says they're presented with warmth, occasional anger, and frequent wit. Michael admits to being a big fan of the book, so he couldn't wait to meet the author in person.
My name is Andy Kwan. I was born in Vancouver on the west coast of Canada. I've been in Australia and Sydney for just over 3 years now. I was living in London before that and decided that 4 years of gray European winters, I needed a bit of a sun, really. Also, there's that deal with young Canadians who can get working holidaymaker visas to be here in Australia for a year. So came over to try my luck and managed to get a work visa to stay longer. So I'm working here at the Australian Federation of AIDS Organizations, AFAO, as the International Policy Officer. I'm also a board member this year of the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, and I play footy with the Proud Out and Open Football Touch Association every Sunday with the PUFTAs.
You do have a history of publishing.
Sure. I've been publishing short stories and poetry in various places, starting in Canada for, you know, over 10 years. I had my first short story published in Canada's first collection of gay fiction, which was called Queries. And that story has gone on to be the very first story in my new short story collection, Calendar Boy. Since then, I've had short stories published all over the place, various Canadian anthologies, an anthology called Circa 2000, Best Gay Fiction at the Millennium. I was very pleased to get in that one because it had a number of authors that I quite admire, Colm Tóibín and David Levitt, you know, quite a number of big names in that one. Another recent one was in an anthology of queer Asian writing called Takeout. And poetry as well in a number of literary magazines. And then finally, just this last summer, northern summer, in June, July of 2001, I got both my first collections of poetry and short fiction published at the same time in Canada.
So you've been busy. Were most of the stories written in Canada?
They were written all over the place. There are 16 stories ranging back from you know, stories written in the last year to almost 10 years ago. The majority are set in Canada, probably, but there's a number of them set in Europe as well and written there where I was living. And the last three are set in Australia. And I wrote a few of the other ones here when I was in Australia. So, you know, I wrote a story set in Canada or one set in Europe while I was here in Australia.
For the most part, you write in the first person singular. In other words, you refer to the key character as I. Mm-hmm. How much of that is autobiographical?
Most of the stories, or a lot of the stories, are autobiographical. Some of them aren't. There's one story in there which was made of completely, it's about a gay couple, completely fictional characters, called Wreck Beach, where I tried it in different voices, and I tried to write it not in the first person, and it didn't work. It's an older story, so I've tried it a number of times, and when I finally put it into the first person, again, because I tried it before, but when I put it in the first person, that's when it worked out again. So sometimes I think that first person voice is quite strong. The strange thing is that because it's there, this I in the story, people automatically assume it's the author. I've had that with a number of reviewers, some who comment on the number of different characters in the book, and some who can't figure out the difference between any of the characters that say I.
I must admit that I do think of writing in as I as quite brave, because sometimes things can be written which are very delicate in nature, which people assume belong to the author. Have you had those qualms?
I kind of try to pretend that it's not happening. You know, on the other hand, you know, some of the authors that I very much like write in the first person, or even if they're not, they're stories that are about the author in some ways, Edmund White or David Levitt. And I do the same thing. You know, when I'm reading the book, I'm thinking, I wonder if this is true, or did this really happen? And I know from doing that to other people that people would be thinking the same about my characters. I try not to think about it. It's a bit embarrassing, really.
A lot of the stories deal with the character as Chinese in a Western country, born in a Western country, growing in a Western country. And I found that extremely interesting. I also find myself seeing bits and pieces of myself in there. Beyond that, do you think there is a common thread to most of these stories?
I think that most of the stories are dealing with similar issues. And even the ones that are, you know, specifically looking at, say, a gay Asian identity or the experiences of, you know, a young gay Asian man in Canada or in Europe. At the same time, I think that they're dealing with a lot bigger issues. They're dealing with issues about friendship and community, how we belong or how we exclude people from our groups of friends or from our communities. A lot of them are about discovery. You know, it's about discovering what dating is like, about discovering what it's like to come out, what it's discovering what it's like to identify oneself as gay. I found it frustrating when I've heard people, you know, I've had a lot of reviews, and they've been very mixed, you know, good ones and bad ones. So I think it's quite interesting that some people are understanding or connecting me with my writing, and others aren't. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're only people who are like me. You know, I've had a lot of people who connect with my writing regardless of race or gender or sexuality, and others who read it and say, well, this isn't really about me, so I don't understand it.
I certainly identified a lot with the character, the various characters who were trying to make their way into the scene, coping with how to read signals, how to pick up boyfriends, the troubles that comes with that. I found it extremely interesting, and you certainly have a way of writing with a lot of wit and humor, which I liked a lot. So yes, certainly there's a whole lot there which a lot of people will find experiences in, I think, their own experience.
Well, I hope so. I think, you know, I try to describe a particular, I think that's one of the things that I try to do in writing, is if you describe your own particular experience, it probably says something about other experiences and other people's stories as well. By doing that, then I'm hoping that it will connect to a lot of people. But, you know, the experiences of the gay community, I've read, you know, I often read stories or articles about being gay, and it's almost like it's this ready-made existence. Whereas it's a created culture. All of our cultures are created. A straight society is also created as well. So we all have the codes that we are living by or supposed to live by, and the signals that we're supposed to pick up. You know, and if you don't fit in, you have to figure out what those are.
Shave your head.
Could be. That would be, you know, one of the stories in the collection is called Hair. There was a trend in the gay community that took me a while to notice. Randolph, of course, noticed right away, but knowing some of the background to my long mane of hair and secretly liking its connection to my name, Samson, kept his mouth shut. The trend followed the same reasoning as the shaved chest phenomenon. If a hairless body at this point in our history was somehow more masculine and hygienic, what about hairless heads? Gay men were shaving their skulls, their pates peeking out into daylight. Some had blue veins, some had razor cuts, others had odd bumps and lumps. If they were not shiny bald, then at least hair was short. Short, like crew cuts, a military illusion, or short everywhere except for a cowlick that would rise up from the brow like the Belgian comic book character Tintin. I began thinking seriously about this trend. After all, it had been 4 years since I had seen my hair short, and I was admittedly tired of the long black hairs that would appear everywhere, thick Asian strands in the carpet, in the sink, in the shower, and on bathroom tiles. I wasn't tired of the attention, but I was tired that it only came from women. There was, I must recount, a crudely drawn poster outside Toronto's Glad Day bookstore that advertised a club for long-haired gay men and men who love them. But to me, this seemed no different from the specialty classified ads that appeared in the back of the community biweekly seeking bootlicking sleighs or water sport fanatics. To the mainstream gay man, I was definitely out of fashion. Still, it was not an easy decision to cut my hair. When I told friends, most lamented what a shame it would be to lose such hair. Perhaps something clicked when I spoke with Terry, an actor friend of a friend. People always told me how intelligent he was, but I'd never seen this. He seemed to express only mild interest in me, and we only made idle chit-chat when we met. Besides, I was envious. I was deeply attracted to his physical form, a blonde boy next door with a handsome, rugged face, a football player's physique, a body that somehow avoided looking too planned and precise, unlike those of so many others on the gay scene. "Don't listen to that crap," he said, his eyes elsewhere in the bar, sneaking a look at who his ex-boyfriend was talking to. "Why would you follow some stupid trend? Why would you need to follow the crowd? Gay people can be so superficial." His gaze shifted to watch a tall brunette cross the floor. "That's not a comment on you. It's just, why would you need to?" I adjusted my ponytail, my hair drawn back and held by a thin black elastic. "It's a game," I thought to myself. "Checkers, parcheesi, poker. I want to play, and how can I play if people won't even let me into the game?" I got up to leave and felt a flash of anger. I swallowed it. Heat bounced uneasily against my interiors. Terry could wear whatever he wanted, the most out-of-style clothes, the most garish colors. He could grow his hair into a river of blonde. He could keep his chest unshaven if it wasn't already. He would still be pursued, as he probably had been pursued all his life, men buckling at the knees at first sight of him. And he would never know that he did not need to play the game, because he was it. He was the game. When I shaved my head, I felt glorious. It was a nice surprise to learn my parents had given me a strong, round skull. I sent my braid to a Chinese-Canadian artist friend who thought he could work it into his next piece, a pseudo-museum display on the cultural artifacts of a composite Chinese-Canadian family. I showered and felt the hot spray directly on my head. My hair did not need drying. The number of hairs in the carpet slowly diminished. Most important, I walked along sunny Church Street and felt the weather on the very top of my body, and amazingly, like a miracle predicted but not believed in, head swiveled, other eyes caught mine. There is no way to describe to someone with no experience of swimming in the ocean how the salt smell rises into your head to the heights of your senses, how every inch of what surrounds you feels alive and in motion, how the salt leaves its traces on your skin as you leave the water. Ever since I'd come out of the closet, I had had long hair, and I'd never known what it was like to be close-shaven. More accurately, I had never known what it was like to be recognizably gay, and to walk on a gay street on a hot summer day. With all that mess of hair, the denizens of my gay world saw only an exotic creature with foreign roots. They could not see my desire through the forest of hair, could not name me as one of them. For with my skin already a different color, they needed another signal to call me their own. Shaving my head, I had learned to play the game I wanted to play. How many of you have ever seen your head bald, seen the lines and veins and patterns of the skull, to see how nature has formed that skull without the adornment of hair? That summer I saw it, and it was a revelation. Its round form showed me the shape of the world in which I was learning to take part.
This current anthology and the Kwan's Calendar Boy we're talking about, at least some of the grounding of the stories are about being Canadian Chinese, growing up in a predominantly white-dominated society or a group of societies in this case. And I'd say that you certainly have plenty to be pissed off at. And I think it comes out much clearer that anger maybe at times in, for instance, the short story, What I Really Hate. And yet even in that story, it's sort of tempered by, on the one hand, certain wryness. You're also looking at yourself and laughing at yourself. So there's a fair bit of humor, even at the worst moment, so to speak. Is that something you work on deliberately, or is it just your character?
I have gone through, a lot of periods of being somewhat angry. I'm not a very angry person, but there's definitely things I've been angry about. I was involved in a lot of student politics when I was younger, in gay and lesbian community politics. And I've seen a number of people who carry anger around them on their shoulders all the time, who are constantly angry. And, you know, some of those people are fantastic because they get things done and they change things. But I also think that at other times it's not particularly helpful to stay in that place. If I'm writing about racism in the community and experiences that have happened to me, you know, I'm not writing because I want people to say, oh, that poor guy, or this is horrible. I'd really like it to be used for people to go, okay, how do people around me treat other people? How do I treat other people? What can we learn from this? What aspects of our culture, which, you know, in this case is part of the gay culture, you know, how do we welcome people or not? And I think generally it's a good idea to be welcoming.
That was Andy Kwan, the author of Calendar Boy, a collection of 16 short stories published by Penguin Books. He read from one of them entitled Hair. Andy Kwan was interviewed by Michael Schembri in Sydney, Australia. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Brian Nunes, Sherry Lunn, Cindy Friedman, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambage, Rex Walkner, and Michael Schembri contributed program material. Margie Adam performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, www.thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help in This Way Out's critical struggle to stay on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks very much for listening on CJSR Edmonton, Alberta, MVS Radio Amsterdam, the Netherlands, WDFH Oceaning, New York, and on more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.